Back with you, busy show Thursday, March 25th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Cheryl Chumley joined us in the 3 o'clock hour, the bottom of the hour. She is the editorial page editor for the webpage for the Washington Times. She gave us her thoughts on the Biden presidency so far and a news conference held by Mr. Biden, the first of his presidency, earlier in the day. 4 p.m. hour kicked off with the latest COVID briefing from Governor Ned Lamont. In the 5 o'clock hour, we talked to the head of the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling, vis-a-vis the apparent introduction soon to be in Connecticut of legalized sports gambling and iGaming. Also in the show, we took a call from a gentleman who had a very interesting perspective on legal and illegal immigration. The President, Joe Biden, wrapping up his first news conference of his first term a few minutes ago, actually about 40 minutes ago. He went for about an hour and change, I think, hour and five, hour and ten, I believe. Touched on a bunch of things, including, of course, COVID vaccinations, the border problem at the southern U.S. border with all these unaccompanied kids coming over. And he also talked a little foreign policy, including accusing North Korea of violating U.N. rules by restarting some of its missile testing.
UN Resolution 1718 was violated by those particular missiles that were tested.
So he was asked, what, if anything, can the U.S. do?
If they choose to escalate, we will respond accordingly.
And he added,
I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy, but it has to be conditioned upon the end result of denuclearization.
All right, so we'll be bringing you little snippets of what the president had to say throughout the show. If you watched any of it, let us know what you think. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. George has been holding a while in Bridgeport. Hey, George, you're on WICC. What's up?
Yes, I just want to comment about all the little children that's crossing the border.
Yes, sir.
The reason most of these people come in is because poverty. And
yeah.
You don't fight poverty bringing everybody here. Mm-hmm. Mexico and Central America is not the poorest country in the whole world. I'm Puerto Rican. My mm-hmm. wife is from El Salvador.
Okay.
And we've been married for 47 years.
God bless
we
you.
We did everything. We did everything by the book.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is a U.S. citizen for the last 35, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
We did everything accordingly with the book. For every family that comes into the United States fighting poverty, it is another 1,000 families waiting to come in. So this is a war that we are going to win. And it is not just United States fight. It should be United Nations. What everybody speak about immigrant and things like that, and I feel, because I'm also immigrant.
Yeah.
And I know, I do know what poverty is all about. I grew up in Puerto Rico without, my father passed away when I was 18 months old.
Mm.
On my days, was no social services. What they have to say about our military, about our soldiers, that they come back, they are mentally ill. They come back losing a leg, losing an arm, and they are sleeping under a bridge.
I
come from a family that five of my uncle went to the war in a Korean area, Vietnam, Korea and Panama. But they went to the Second World War II. They all five brothers. My uncles, they went to the front line. They was in the front line. They all came back with a mentally ill.
Oh.
And let me tell you something. They died in misery because the government didn't do anything for them. And 70 years later, we still in the same page.
You know, George, I'm glad you bring this up because I know people say, well, part of the reason these families do this, George, is, as you say, there's rampant poverty, there's rampant corruption, and they want their kids to have a better life. George, I understand that, but as I brought up the other day, I don't know whether you heard me, I said, at what point, I mean, we have sent, George, you well know, to countries like El Salvador and Mexico and Guatemala and these countries. I mean, billions of dollars in world aid, you know, not just from us, but from other countries. And my question is, does it make a difference? I mean, I don't know. Does that ever make a difference?
No, that's why Donald Trump stopped the Honduran's aid. When Donald Trump asked the president of Honduras, what you have been doing with the money we gave you for the last 10 years, they couldn't answer.
Yeah.
They couldn't answer. So what he did, he stopped it.
Said,
we're not going to give you money because they're still coming in and you don't do anything about it.
You've turned the water off, George, until you fix the leaks, right? And then you get. I know.
Exactly. Yeah. If you have a leak in your living room from the bathroom and you fix the ceiling in the living room, you don't do anything. You have to fix the leak first.
Yeah.
So it's the same. It is the same concept. It is the same concept. And again, I got a lot of friends that are from Central America, very good friends, and I do have a lot of respect. But for them, it's what it is. Let's worry about our veterans, that they sleep on their bridge. Let me mention this, so
sure.
I got to go. Before Oprah went off the air on her show, that's a few years ago,
okay.
She had a show about lady veterans that they was in the front line.
Okay.
And she have a beautiful black young woman that she was in the front line.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what was the sad part? She came back and she was sleeping on the bridge with three children.
It is awful. It's awful.
That's it. I don't know what else to say.
George, wonderful phone call, my friend. Thank you. Hope to hear from you again.
Thank you.
George in Bridgeport. George on WICC. Huh, folks, and there you have someone who has, his wife has Central American roots, George from Puerto Rico. His wife, you know, they came here. They did it the right way. It's frustrating, and he brought up the UN and all good things. When the world sends so many of these countries, you know, you talk about world poverty and this and the other, and yeah, it's out there. Where does this money actually go? And maybe there is accounting for it. I don't know. Is it governments? Maybe. I mean, you look at Venezuela. Venezuela still, I think, to this day, and I know there's climate change issues and stuff like that, but I read something once where Venezuela, because of the ocean of oil that's underneath it, before they started electing socialists like Maduro and those people, Venezuela at one time had like the fourth or fifth highest standard of living in the world because of its, you know, natural resources. So again, my question is, and I don't doubt in one bit how some of these people in Mexico and Venezuela and El Salvador and other South American countries are suffering. That's not the point. You take camera crews over there, you see it. Why has this been going on? It's like the argument I always say, folks, about, you know, fixing America's cities. Well, we have to, you know, there are underprivileged people in America's cities. Yes, there are. Why have we been battling this since the 1950s? And here we are 70 years later, and some of these problems are still there. I mean, my God, we started battling this, when you think about it, as we had rockets blowing up on launch pads, right? Now we got rockets up. We orbited satellites. We had three space programs. We got to the moon. We had a space shuttle. We've got private space companies. Now we're going back to the moon. We're going to go to Mars in a few years. And we still can't fix things with America's inner cities and some of these countries in poverty. Who's zooming here? Who's zooming who here, folks? The old song goes, somebody's getting rich and somebody still can't eat at night. His first news conference as commander-in-chief earlier today did the 46th president of the U.S., Joe Biden, to talk about that and more. Our next guest, online opinion editor, The Washington Times, author of the books The Devil in D.C., Winning Back the Country from the Beast in Washington, and author of Police State USA, How Orwell's Nightmare is Becoming Our Reality. She also hosts the Bold and Blunt podcast. Cheryl Chumley joins us here on WICC. Hi, Cheryl. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Hey, Paul. It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it personally. Love the Washington Times. Check it out the time, multiple times a day. Did you get a chance to watch any of the news conference? And if so, what did you think?
I watched every bit of it. And I was a little bit dismayed. I actually posted a piece. The headline says it all. Biden exposes self as weak and wandering, and that's bad news for America. And, you know, you can giggle at this guy and at his difficulty in forming a complete sentence, but it's not good news for America when you have the world watching this. And he didn't just make gaffes. He made obvious mental meanderings. His mind just shut down, it seemed like, in several key places. And he wasn't even handed any difficult questions to field.
Did I hear, Cheryl, correct me if I'm wrong, but did I see that some of these questions were pre-screened or preordained? Did you hear or see anything about that? Or were these spontaneous? Do you know?
Well, I heard talk that the questions, of course, were going to be pre-screened, but I haven't heard any confirmation on that or read any confirmation. But look, common sense will tell you that all the questions came from the friendly fires, right? It was the NPRs, it was the ABC, CBS. There weren't any questions that were allowed, even from Fox News. And, you know, there are plenty of Fox News journalists who have been able to ask a lot of questions of Jen Psaki, yeah. Which is surprising sometimes. So you think maybe Biden would have fielded one from one conservative organization, but he did not.
You know, Cheryl, I think we're in the kind of this period, called it a honeymoon, call, you know, whatever people like to use in our business. You know, I think the, well, I'm not Trump thing, or he's not Trump, which to a lot of my friends who I know and love was just enough. Like, okay, he's 78, but he ain't Trump. How long do you think can the White House ride that, coupled with the improving conditions on COVID-19? 6 months, a year? What do you think?
Well, if the media did its job, that honeymoon period would be over right now. Because if you just look at the border, his messaging of "I'm not Trump," which is what he campaigned on, has been an utter failure. And some in the mainstream media are even recognizing that, like NBC News, that was questioning just a few days ago, hey, when can we get to the border and actually see what's going on down there and ask some valid questions? And again, there was a question at this press conference, hey, President Biden, are you going to be transparent about the border? And he promises that he will be, but he has not yet. And so if you just skip on over to coronavirus, where on one hand, he blames Donald Trump for the border issues, which is ridiculous. But on the other hand, he doesn't give Donald Trump credit for Operation Warp Speed, which was magnificent. That's the reason why we're at where we're at right now in the vaccination world. It defies logic that Joe Biden wants to play both these issues. And honestly, some in the mainstream media may carry water for him a while longer, but that message is crumbling fast.
Cheryl, hang on. Going to do a quick traffic report, then back with you. So we'll be back with you momentarily. Hang on. Cheryl Chumley is the guest. She, of course, the online opinion editor for The Washington Times. She hosts a podcast as well, Bold and Blunt, a couple of books as well. More with Cheryl Chumley straight ahead. First traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. And yeah, I would think folks in Stratford, all over Fairfield County, New Haven County, Hartford County, talking about the president's first news conference today. We continue to discuss that a few more minutes with the online opinion editor at The Washington Times. Of course, check it out, WashingtonTimes.com. Cheryl Chumley. Cheryl, the border issue, couple of things here. Number one, I'm not surprised that this is happening at all when you did almost an entire campaign in which you wasted little time at almost every opportunity saying, hey, whatever we're doing now, we're going to do much different if and when I'm elected or you vote for our guy. You know, the second thing here, too, Cheryl, on this is a lot of Democrats now, Democratic members of Congress, Dick Durbin the other day, some other people saying, hey, the midterms are closer than you think. We don't need to have this problem as soon as possible here. So I don't know what's ahead for this.
Yeah, because remember, it was the border issue primarily that brought Donald Trump into the political arena. He was the one that campaigned on Kate Steinle and the horror that became our national security when illegals could shoot somebody on a pier in California in front of her father and kill her. And this was a guy that had been previously deported like five times. And it was Donald Trump who constantly raised that border issue using Kate Steinle as sort of a platform. And so now Democrats are reading the political tea leaves. They see the disaster at the border that began almost immediately on Inauguration Day. And now here we are 60 days later, and we've got thousands of unaccompanied minor children at the border now clamoring for new homes. And so Democrats don't want to lose the House and Senate right as they got it. I mean, they've only held it for a short time, and they don't want to turn it over to Republicans so quickly. So Democrats are finding themselves in the uncomfortable spot right now of having to actually do something about border control. And they're used to just letting it ride and letting Republicans take the lead. But they're the ones that are going to take the blame because they're in the majority.
On a lot of other issues, Cheryl, whether it's infrastructure now coming up, whether it's the clamoring for more laws on guns, whether it is the border, there's this buzz about, hey, do we get rid of the filibuster? Or, as the president said today, well, let's go back to, you know, the old-fashioned filibuster where people had to sit there and talk for 40 hours before the other side said, well, okay, uncle, what changes do you want in this bill? What do you foresee happening there? What do you think?
I think panicked Democrats are going to push hard to get rid of it because they think it's their only way that they're going to be able to push through their agenda before Republicans take control of the House and Senate. I mean, their time is coming to a quick end because it's not going to take long for a lot of those Biden supporters out there who maybe didn't vote for Trump because, say, they didn't like his Twitter feed, but they're not fully on board with the far-left socialist agenda that has taken over the Democrat Party, they're going to have buyer's remorse soon enough. And I think Democrats are just going to look at this next few months as their Hail Mary to push through as much of their agenda as they can before they lose the House and Senate.
Boy, you've got both major parties here, Cheryl, really with schisms or divisions here. You've got the centrist Democrats trying to fight off, or the traditional D's, I should say, fighting off the far left. And let's talk about what's going on in the Republican Party now, because the establishment crowd is still there. And, you know, I don't think Mr. Trump is going away anytime soon. And you read in your publication and others, the wheels already turning for some Trump or Trump side backing on some of these candidates coming up.
Yeah, the Democrats have a bigger problem with their schism because the Democrats are so far out of tune and out of touch with what most of America still longs for this country. And the fact is, you can look at the Democrat Party and say there's an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez faction, and then there's a more moderate faction. But really, the moderate faction has caved to the far leftists. And they may not be out there as loudly as AOC is, but they pretty much let the socialist agenda take over where their party pushes politically. They're just a little bit sneakier about it. They use different language and rhetoric. They call it something like environmental justice instead of socialism. And if you look at the Republican Party, the Republican Party still has that same sort of split that it had back in 2000. 2016. And so it's not as if the elitists and the globalists in the Republican Party have gained since Trump left the White House. It's just that they're still standing, that's all. But by and large, the people who supported Donald Trump, 75 million plus of them, are still out there in America, and they're not going to let the Republican Party go back to the pre-Donald Trump days, where it was all about working deals with the Democrats behind closed doors.
Cheryl, final question, and I don't ask this question in any sort of macabre or morose way, but do you see President Biden, with all the conjecture here, does he serve out a full 4 years? Is the part of the plan here, as some people, theory, to hand it off to the vice president at some point or not?
Well, that's not a macabre question. That's based on reality. I mean, look at the guy. Seriously, this is the president of the United States who fumbles to find the pocket to put his pen back in. And, if you think he was having a bad day then, all you had to do is watch the press conference today and see that, geez, he's getting worse mentally, not better. That, combined with his frequent reference of his Vice President Harris as President Harris, and that combined with all the talk about how Harris was basically being prepped to take over Joe Biden's position, and that combined with the far leftist influences that have been pressing the puppet Joe Biden in the White House since day one, tells me that, whether he makes it physically or not to the end of his term, it doesn't matter, because it's going to be the same far left interest that is leading through the White House. And that's not Joe Biden so much. It's the socialist, progressive, Marxist, communist of the party.
Check out our podcast, Bold and Blunt, the books, The Devil in D.C., Winning Back the Country from the Beast in Washington, and Police State USA, How Orwell's Nightmare is Becoming Our Reality. The online opinion editor at The Washington Times, Cheryl Chumley. Cheryl, thank you. Appreciate it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Let's talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you. God bless.
Appreciate it, Cheryl. Cheryl Chumley there, the online opinion editor of the Washington Times. Didn't pull too many punches there, did she? No.
Stanford Hospital, and Jerry Reyes, who represents Waterbury and head of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, and they'll give us some insights in terms of how things are changing in their part of the state and what we're doing to get more people vaccinated. Quickly on the numbers, what do I see here? I see we're continuing to do a lot of testing. Other states are falling off. Hospitalizations relatively stable, deaths continue relatively stable, positivity rate creeping up, and that's what we're going to talk about a little bit today. It's not my number one metric. I care more about hospitalizations, but I do care about the fact that, we've gone from 2.2% 7-day average, 2-3 weeks ago, to about 3.7 today, so it's up by 50-60%. I see that our friends in New Jersey are up at close to 8% as a 7-day moving average. And the greater Northeast in general is, I'm afraid, leading the country in many ways in terms of infections, in terms of some seasonality going on. And that's what we're going to discuss a little bit today. So the next chart is just a reminder to keep your guard up. And it looks a little bit like the chart maybe did in the spring, when you saw the virus coming up from the New York metro area. You see the reddest part of the state is down in southwest Connecticut. Probably the Valley has got some of the highest infection rates right now, Derby, Ansonia, Bethany. I do want you to know that when you see these cases per 100,000, and you look around the rest of the country and say, what's going on? I just want you to remember something Josh pointed out to me. We have 10 times as many people test per 100,000 as they do, say, in Mississippi. So it's tough to compare state to state because the differences in testing are dramatic. But it just gives you an idea of where the infections are right now, which we're watching closely. This next chart, I think, is a hopeful chart in this sense. You can see the decline in cases based upon age. And you can see that the purple line, if your eyes are really good, which mine are, 80-plus, has dropped the most, 70 to 79, 60 to 69. That's where the lowest percentages of infections are taking place. It's just a reminder that the vaccines are working. We saw that previously when we showed you what's going on in nursing homes over the last few months. This is a broader look across the population based on age. And, you know, a little creep up, by the way, 20 to 29, 30 to 39. Those are the numbers you see in the, you know, orange and the such. So that's where the infections are taking place. It's a younger demographic. Less complications, but perhaps a little less caution as well. Next chart. How are we doing on the vaccines? I think we're doing okay. We've got 80% of our folks 75 and above. You know, that's if we can get 80% of all of our population, we'll be doing pretty well. 38% of all of our adults 16 and above have now received their first dose. 38%. And that's ramping up. We did about 150,000 this past week. We'll be doing 200,000 doses, 200,000 vaccinations next week, which means gives us a little bit of flexibility as we aggressively go vaccinate people. Pfizer is picking up a little bit. Johnson & Johnson is picking up quite a bit. Next chart. Because of the accelerating ability to get people vaccinated, we're getting people vaccinated at a higher percentage, and more importantly, we're getting a lot more vaccines. Just a little chart that we sometimes enjoy. The percent of our population who have been given their first dose. The national average is 25.7. The champion, New Mexico, Alaska, Connecticut, South Dakota, Massachusetts. It makes a big difference. That represents tens of thousands of people who have been vaccinated who are safe, and that's reflected in lower complications and fatalities. So what that means is with more vaccinations, more vaccines, more people getting vaccinated, we had originally thought April 5th would be a day that we could open the aperture for everybody, regardless of age, to be able to make their appointment for a vaccine. We're going to move that forward a few days to April 1st. That's in 1 week. That means that starting April 1st in 1 week, everybody will be able to you know, make that appointment. Again, it's going to be a rush at the gate. We understand that. But we're finding we had a fair number of doses available in our appointment schedule, you know, as days went on. And I know that many of you still in the 45 and above age group still looking for that vaccination. 200,000 more appointments next week. Check frequently because every day we get new doses, new appointments open up. And that'll be a very important opportunity. The age-based system that Connecticut and a few other states have prioritized are making a difference. And they're making a difference in terms of saving lives, which is one of our number one priorities, is our number one priority. And I think one of the reasons is because we're fairly strict about it, there were less people and running, less ability for others to jump ahead of those that are older than them. And you can see Connecticut is the yellow line on this chart. And you can see the yellow line, if 100 is the baseline, let's say we're all at the same on January 3rd, we have gone down by probably 75-85% in terms of our fatalities against that baseline. You can see for other states, it's been very different because they've had different prioritizations. They've prioritized different groups. They haven't been focused quite on the most vulnerable, which are those 75 and above, then 65 and above. New York probably has they've gone down by about half. If we've gone down by about, 80 or 90%. Not to pick on any state per se, but it just shows you, I think, the age-based system worked pretty well. I know Paul Hughes is going to ask me, what does that line for Rhode Island mean? And I can't tell you. I think sometimes the data comes in, it's very erratic. Rhode Island's the red line. You see it spiked up on February 21st, then went way down. A lot of the information we're getting is erratic. But the rest of those numbers, I think, are very consistent and should give you some confidence that because we've had a higher percentage of our seniors vaccinated in just about any state, that's making a real difference in terms of reducing fatalities. You know, finally, we're going to continue to do everything we can to make sure that the folks who are most vulnerable get vaccinated. And this is going to be becoming increasingly important as J&J and others ramp up the amount of vaccines that are available to us. Pretty soon, supply will hit demand. And at that point, we've really got to go out there and do everything we can to convince you, convince your friends to get vaccinated. So we put together a $58 million budget to go out and do everything we can to encourage people to get vaccinated. That starts with telephoning and door-to-door canvassing and using trusted advocates and using ministers at the churches, doing everything we can to make it easier to bring the vaccine to you, bring the mobile vans to you. And so you're going to see a ramped-up effort over the course of the next few weeks in order to do that. And I've got two friends here who could help us describe some of our efforts and what they're seeing. First, as I said, was Kathy Szilard. I was there with Kathy in Stanford Hospital. I think it was a few weeks ago. They introduced their program, No Barriers. Stanford has done an extraordinary job of not only getting a lot of people vaccinated, but getting those most at risk vaccinated. And Kathy, more broadly, I'd love to hear what you're seeing, how the infections have changed over the last few weeks, what we might expect.
Sure. Thank you, Governor, for having me. So our test positivity rate in Stanford was 3.2% this week. We were definitely seeing it come down, but not where we needed to be. Hospitalizations are also coming down. We have 19 inpatients today and only two in the ICU. So patients are a lot less critically ill, and that's on a basis of about 270 patients in-house today. We're seeing exactly what you're talking about, that the median age for COVID-19 patients has come down, and that's because of the vaccine, because of social distancing, good safety measures that have been in place, and that's all positive news. But I'm always reminded when I walk through the ICU, this is not over, and we have to stay vigilant on everything that we're doing. To date, we've taken care of 1,300 inpatients, and we've tested 190,000 individuals. I'm really proud of how Connecticut has fared during this pandemic, and particularly around the vaccine. In Stanford, 21% of our citizens have actually received the first dose of the vaccine. And today, we achieved the lofty goal of having delivered 60,000 doses in our city. And I saw this as my moral and ethical responsibility to our community, and we have moved quickly and swiftly to do so. We also did something I think a little unique in that we decided to partner with the city of Stanford instead of operating parallel clinics to distribute vaccine. We've worked together, and that has helped a lot. And on the 15th of the month, we opened up a second mega site, and Building Land Technology helped us to do that. And we are going gangbusters. We actually delivered 11,000 doses last week, and we're hiring 50 more people to up that number next week. 65% of our staff have been vaccinated, and we continue to work on that. Governor, you spoke about the No Barriers program, and that's one where we saw early on how these vulnerable populations, particularly the Black and Latinx communities, were so impacted. And so working with the Vita Health and Wellness Initiative and the high-risk, the COVID-19 high-risk community outreach task force, we did outreach to the community through this event. And what the No Barriers program is that we hold special clinics for the individuals in those groups where they come in and they get the vaccine and there are no questions asked. We do ask for identification if they don't have it. We still provide the vaccine, and we want to make sure that we're getting the penetration to that community. We're doing one every single week, and we have now vaccinated over 1,300 individuals. And I would mention that it is so important for the No Barriers program that we work with the trusted partners in our community, like Building One Community, like the NAACP, the churches, those dedicated groups that have the trust relationship with those individuals so they can help us open the doors and build the trust around getting the vaccine. I'm really happy to tell you that we have some new news in that the Alexandra and Stephen Cohen Foundation have given us a grant to do community outreach going door to door to get the word out in those communities about how reliable and safe the vaccine is and how it's easy for them to get it. And we would not be able to execute the program without, I said, those partners, Dr. Tabitha Fort, Cecilia DeRosa, and the Jackie Robinson Foundation. AmeriCares also, and Charter Oak Communities, and we will stay vigilant on that. I also just want to remind people to come back for care. I'm very concerned when I look at the trends across our nation about people neglecting heart care, cancer care, postponing seeing their primary care physician. One of our doctors told me about two advanced cancers that he diagnosed last week in patients that should have been seen over a year ago in the primary care practice. So like every other hospital across our state, we have great safety measures in place, and we want to make sure people continue to care for themselves while we battle this pandemic.
Beautiful, Kathy. Thank you. And Kathy mentioned trusted advocates are the best people to convince others to get vaccinated. Jerry Reyes is chairman of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus. You've done yeoman's work in Waterbury. Tell us what you're seeing and how we can help.
Thank you very much, Governor, for having me. And the city of Waterbury is what I consider one of the leaders in the state of Connecticut, and when it's come to citywide coverage and especially addressing communities of color. I've had the opportunity to speak with Commissioner Giffner and her team, and when we first started this conversation, we were a little lacking in communities of color, and I have to compliment the commissioner and the Department of Public Health for Commissioner of Health for actually writing that correcting that action, if you will. I believe that recently, with the recent activities, when we've actually gone into the inner cities, in the recreation centers, into the different churches, different faith-based organizations, we have done a tremendous job of actually going into the inner city. And we're looking at the coverage gap where the commissioner presented to us a couple nights ago, 54% Caucasian, 38% African-American, and 37% Hispanic, which is a great increase over when we first started quite some time ago. I have to tell you that the Waterbury Hospital and St. Mary's Hospital and so many of the providers have been doing an excellent job in conjunction with the city of Waterbury. One that I'm very familiar with is the local Hispanic Coalition in the south end of Waterbury that's been vaccinating our aging population. We started out with our seniors, and then we went on to those that were 65 and older, and now 55 and over, and we're really making inroads. It just goes to show you that familiarity breeds comfort, and comfort will allow people that even were hesitant to take the shot to actually take it. And I have to say that the BPRC has been very respondent when it came to supporting and advocating for communities of color to get the shots. And our challenge to every BPRC member was when you were eligible to make sure you got your shot. And as they get the shot, we post it on our webpage and on our social media pages. So the reason being that we're trying to do is actually advocate and show people it's safe. You can get it. You can trust it. If you see trusted leaders getting it, you can get it. You'll trust and go and get it yourself. I am very happy with the work that's been done in the city of Waterbury, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank Mayor O'Leary and one of the main organizers, Mr. Adam Wrinkle, who started out with the COVID-19 tested and then quickly went into the vaccination as soon as they became eligible. We need to make more continuing inroads, and I was happy to hear from the commissioner last night speaking about next steps, more inroads into the inner cities, and then the next step is actually maybe even getting vans out and getting people door-to-door and actually coming out with people that are going to canvas the neighborhood and get those. If we get 80% of the state, as you said, Governor, then these folks can go out and get the last 20%. A lot of this reminds me so much of the census work. But I have to be complimentary of the commissioner and her work. And also, Governor Lamont, you for your leadership, sir. Thank you.
And we've been talking about this issue since I started here 2 years ago regarding the what people likely saw and now do see, apparently closer than ever, the legalization of sports gambling, sports betting in the state. It's all around us. Along with now iGaming, internet and phone gaming, other aspects of this mega bill that's going through. Well, some folks, and you've called me on this for the past couple of years, concerned about the effects it could have, A, on people who have problems with compulsive gambling, and B, is it going to create more compulsive gamblers? Well, joining us right now is Diana Good. She is executive director of the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling, an organization that handles those very issues, to talk about this. Diana, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good, Diana, and great that we can have you on. Thanks for taking the time here. I imagine how busy you are. Give me your initial thoughts as they are right now with what you have seen passed so far here in the General Assembly and what I guess, barring a major court challenge, is likely to take root here sooner or later. What are your overall thoughts on where we stand right now?
So I always start the conversation by saying that the Connecticut Council isn't for or against gambling. We are not the fun police. We are not here to tell people how to spend their disposable income. We just want to make sure, as gambling becomes easier, more accessible on your phone, that there are safeguards in place for people who gamble and run into trouble. There are plenty of people who gamble and they don't run into trouble. They can gamble for fun. They can stop when they need to. We aren't worried about those people. We are very concerned about the people who can't stop gambling, especially as it becomes easier. One of the statistics we always talk about is if you live within 40 miles of a casino, the odds double that you will develop a problem with gambling. Once gambling is on your phone, everyone is going to have a casino in their house. So we definitely think that the problem with disordered gambling is only going to get worse as gambling becomes easier.
And I remember, Diana, interviewing folks from your organization years ago, pre-smartphone, when we had those old clunky cell phones that could basically just barely make a call that didn't drop out. I do remember your organization giving me that 40-mile radius figure, but man, I said this earlier today, and I said, folks, you have to understand, because a lot of people, Diana, don't know about, you know, the phrase iGaming. They get the sports angle of it because, you know, everybody had that neighborhood bookie, so they get that. But I'm saying, no, there are going to be casino games on your wireless device, and I can imagine the concern that your group and groups like yours have about that.
Absolutely. It also opens it up to credit cards. Before, you couldn't buy lotto tickets on credit cards, but now you can. Once it becomes iLottery and you can buy lottery tickets on your phone. So that's another issue. People will be going into debt to fund a gaming habit.
Was your group involved and or consulted, Diana, in any way during the assembly of this bill or the public comment? Did you folks have anything to do with this at all as far as advice given or testimony asked for?
Yeah, we were definitely able to testify about all of these bills. We were also really lucky to be taken very seriously by members of the Public Safety Committee. We really saw this coming. We've been testifying for the last 2 years and seeing all of the momentum around these bills. You know, we understand that a lot of people think this is the silver bullet to get the state out of debt. We definitely understand that. We just want to make sure that safeguards are in place. So a lot of members of public safety were fantastic about taking our phone calls, taking our meetings, reaching out to us about how they can design these bills to mitigate the harm.
You know, Diana, you alluded to this a couple of seconds ago, and having done shows on this, you know, for the 20 or 30 years I've been doing these kinds of shows, it's maddening, isn't it? And it's basically biochemical in a lot of aspects of this when, as you say, and I say this all the time, Diana, I worked in Las Vegas doing a show like this. And in the 6 months I was there, I dropped $20 maybe in a casino once. I had no compunction to do it. I was more concerned about the buffets there and eating there. But there are people, as you say, that can go and have a good time once or twice a year or every few months. But then there are people, and I've heard stories, Diana, whose lives are absolutely wrecked by this stuff.
And not just the gambler, but the gambler's families. A lot of times, the real draw about gambling is you're not sure what's going to happen. You're probably not going to win, but you might win. As opposed to other addictions where if you shoot heroin, if you drink a 30-pack of beer, you know what's going to happen. With gambling, it becomes so much more addictive because you don't know what's going to happen. And it often drags down the entire family because the gambler keeps thinking, eventually I'm going to win. I'm going to win my money back and then I'll stop. And that very rarely happens. A, you rarely win your money back, and B, you rarely stop when you've got this kind of addiction. So normally, by the time someone raises their hand to say they have a problem, they've drained their 401k, they've probably drained their kids' college fund, there's a second mortgage in the house no one knows about. So we've had recovering gamblers come to us and say they don't even have a family member who will let them borrow $10 to get to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting because they just don't believe that that's what's going to happen. And they completely cut these people off. And that's so dangerous. When you look at other addictions, you really need to rely on your family and your friends to get you through it. And a lot of times gamblers don't have that luxury.
Diana Good is the guest executive director of the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. They're on the web at ccpg.org. You know, you alluded to this, Diana, a couple of seconds ago. The way the anticipation works with gambling and gaming versus, yeah, you know how you can get drunk, you can smoke enough pot to fall asleep and whatever. You know, I've had psychiatric professionals in my family, and I guess we find more and more, Diana, that some people, basically a biochemical issue, that rush, that anticipation that, hey, I've got this figured out, I'm going to win. It is so powerful. It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
It really is. It is definitely mind-boggling.
As we move forward with this, are you folks gearing up in any way? Will you be having an effort? I know they said there was money in this bill, Diana, to help people become aware of groups like yourself. What is the next step here as this happens? And I guess I read that some of this could be up and running as soon as July or August. What do you anticipate in the next few months here?
So normally what happens with problem gamblers is it takes a little while for them to hit rock bottom. So we don't anticipate a huge influx of people calling our helpline or reaching out for treatment, but we do anticipate that a year from now, 6 months from now, things are going to be really difficult for a lot of people. So one of the things that we're hoping makes it through all of these bills is additional funding, both for the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling and for Problem Gambling Services, which is a division of the Department of Mental Health. Because one of the things that we really want people to know is that we do have a helpline, a problem gambling helpline that people can call, they can text, they can chat 24/7. Whenever they feel like they have hit rock bottom and they need to reach out for help, they can call, text, or chat. And it's not just for the problem gambler, it's also for a family member. Family members can go into treatment, they can go to Gammonon. There are definitely organizations that can help family members as well.
And, you know, Diana, finally, look, I know how tough this is. I've had a couple of friends who've lost a ton of money doing this. And it's got to make it tough on organizations like yours because years ago, none of the TV networks, very few of the radio networks, they never really talked about point spreads and gambling. I mean, yeah, it was out there. Now, you know, these betting companies, these fantasy leagues, I mean, it's right in the middle of the regular telecast of a game. There's no shying away from this anymore when this used to kind of be in the shadows. That's got to be really frustrating for you folks.
It's really frustrating. I mean, ads during the Super Bowl, that's really frustrating. Absolutely. So, yeah, we definitely don't feel like it's a fair fight. But doing shows like this and having people like you reach out to us to make sure that people know that there is an organization out there that is totally ready to help people makes all the difference in the world.
Diana, thank you. Diana Good, Executive Director of the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. We'll give out the numbers straight ahead. Diana, thank you, and hopefully we can be in touch in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Appreciate it. Diana Good there, the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. Now, if you need help, folks, if you need help as a compulsive gambler, if you think somebody in your family needs help, if you have questions, 888-789-7777. Once again, 888-789-7777, 888-789-7777, the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling.